Welcome back to the Doctor Who Flashcast, where we are wrapping up season one of Doctor Who. That's right. And then there'll be a long break. But before we go, I enjoy greatly spending time with my friends, Chip Sutterth and Erica Ensign. Hi, Chip.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Erica.
Hi, Jason.
Isn't it great that we're together?
I like spending time with my friends.
Yes. Yes. Now we have to talk about this week's episode of Doctor Who.
Oh, we're walking into the remembered TARDIS and remembering the previous episode.
Empire of Death, Season 1, Episode 9, Russell T. Davis. I just want to point out again, I said it numerous times, there's the two Russell T. Davises. There's the one who's the showrunner who feels like he needs to do very specific things for finales and specials and things and first episodes. And then there's the good writer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. The knives are out. I don't know.
I thought you were doing the there are two wolves within you kind of thing.
What do we like about the Empire Death? Because, you know, I didn't think it was very good. But
you know what?
I think
the memory TARDIS. You already mentioned the memory TARDIS. I think that is a very delightful idea of a time window that builds, you know, images based on memories, and the TARDIS being the TARDIS manages to be more than you would expect it to be. And it's this adorable little thing with all kinds of nonsense from previous doctors in there. And it was so good that they decided to then later use it for the Tales of the TARDIS. I mean, that's a winner. That little snippet right there. That's a real winner, I think.
I thought it was kind of beautiful, the whole idea of the memory and what's, memory is time. Time is memory, and what's a memory of a time machine? Maybe it is a time machine. Is memory a time machine? And then it's like they're literally forming the memory TARDIS. And I think it's beautiful and like an interesting, fun fantasy kind of concept of we imagined and remembered and made a TARDIS out of the Doctor's memories and memories of the, like, I love it. What a great idea. What a fun idea that was.
All right, I'll see your remembered TARDIS, and I will raise you a scene that didn't advance the plot very much, but I thought was very well acted and scripted in terms of setting the mood, with the exception of the closing line about, I swear, with a spoon.
You're here.
Which is one of the worst lines in Doctor Who history. That scene with the Doctor... and
the kind woman,
the survivor, that was so well acted and so well scripted, except for that line. You're talking about tone and mood and the sort of thing that Russell T. Davis can do for the entire run of a mid-season episode. I really enjoyed that moment.
I 100% agree with you. I thought it was, I didn't exactly understand why it was happening.
He needed metal.
But I really did like it. And the actress who played the kind woman, I recognized her and had to look it up. She was the sister in Fleabag, which is an excellent show. And I think you're right. Their performances were really great. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, the concept of traveling through a family from the child up to the parent is kind of nonsense. But in a story about time travel in a show, like, that was one of the things that I kind of didn't mind, because taken in this particular scene, which was overall so beautiful except for the spoon thing, I kind of didn't even mind that little bit of hand wavium. That's like one of the bits of hand wavium that I was kind of, it made my heart a little bit warm the second time I watched it, because it was
a beautiful, well done scene that did not make any sense in the episode. That's my problem with it.
Yeah.
Is I felt like, why is this here? Where is it coming from? Where is it going? Were they running short and they shot an extra scene? Because it doesn't follow from anywhere. The only thing that it goes to is that the Doctor breaks the spoon and sticks some spoon in the screen. But it is one of the several things in this episode that, taken on its own, is actually quite nice.
I think the episode needed it to give it some measure of heart, because the episode as a whole doesn't have a wealth of it.
Yeah, I felt like it, to me, what I read it as, earlier we had the doctor saying, you know, I had, was it, I think it's Ruby who says you haven't been everywhere, maybe Mel, anyway, and he says, but I've been to so many places, it's, you know, it's a network that's just going to get everything. So I feel like that planet was one of the places that the doctor had never visited before.
Right.
So the death of Sutekh was coming at it more slowly and from different directions. And it was supposed to illustrate for us that there were still pockets of the universe that had people, but that they were all eventually doomed as well. Which I don't necessarily think we needed that. And honestly, to me, it really felt like some of the scenes in which Chris Chibnall finale was it, where there was just like those weird, you know, tents and people, and
I don't remember which one that was.
I don't remember which one, but honestly, like, it really felt Chris Chibnall finale to me. And at that moment, I thought, you know, I wish I was watching a Chris Chibnall finale. Bring him back.
So no, let's not go that far, Erica.
I did. I went that far, and I was thinking back to his finales, and I was like, you know what? I actually preferred all of them to this.
You know, I wouldn't, I'm noted Chris Chibnall apologist, Chip Sutter, wouldn't necessarily go that far, but I will tell you, this is my least favorite RTD finale of them all, stretching back to 2005. And the nicest thing I want to say about this episode was that it wasn't as bad as The Legend of Ruby Sunday, because this at least had an end and it sort of went somewhere besides playing with anagrams.
I wish I felt that way.
And things that aren't anagrams. I want to underline this point from last week, which is Sutekh is not an anagram.
No, it's not.
No.
It's not. You could. So, but I'm trying to stay on the positive here. I'm going to say, because there's not a lot, really, so I'm trying to find it where I can. I think the idea that a monster has hitched a ride on the TARDIS and has played the ludicrously long game of poisoning every place we've seen the Doctor go, and we haven't seen the Doctor go. Every place the Doctor has gone since Pyramids of Mars has been poisoned by Sutekh. And eventually, after thousands of years, Sutekh gets around to executing his plan. Again, I'm trying to stay positive here. I really like that idea that the Doctor has inadvertently, his travels and his saving people has been inadvertently undermined by the monster hitching a ride on the TARDIS. I think that is a very fun, interesting idea.
I will save my thoughts on that for the negative part, because that's the part I hate the most.
Interesting. Well, like I said, I think it's interesting.
But it's not a bad idea.
Right.
Yeah.
It can be unpleasant to think that it's sort of retroactively doing awful things, and also question, like, is that the game? Is that Sutekh just is hanging out on the top of the TARDIS for thousands of, like,
did he get extra big when the TARDIS went to Trenzalore and started to die?
Did it get extra small?
Did he get
when
exploded?
It got shrunken down?
Did he get exploded in what was it? Not Frontius. One of the Fifth Doctor episodes where the TARDIS gets exploded. Like, I.
No, it doesn't.
In some ways, it's a bad idea.
Can we Photoshop
idea in the notebook of Russell T. Davis of, like, what if monster was poisoning everywhere he went? I'm there for that. It would work better if it had been since the beginning of the season, or since the beginning of since 2005 seasons, or something like that, instead of since 1975. But that's what it was.
Can we Photoshop in a picture of the Idris from the Doctor's wife with a little dog on a leash? I think that would have been necessary.
I think it's already
After the Doctor's wife, any TARDIS shenanigans take on a different sort of flavor. Right. And also the dialogue that RTD used in the previous episode, which I was not here to complain about. I complained about it on Verity. The beast seducing the TARDIS, that made me want to hurl, and seeing the like how that played out made me want to hurl more times. So anyway, no, positive things. I really enjoyed the unit scenes I'm not a big gun battle fan, but it was delightful to see Lenny Rush's little Segway open up and have lasers, and everybody's doing their best. And, you know, as silly as it was to see everybody turn to ash and know that, oh of course, they're all going to come back. It was nice to see Kate Stewart step up and say, like, a touching goodbye. And then when they came back, the the, what's his name? The corporal or Colonel Ibrahim.
Yeah, they hold hands.
Like he helps her up, and then at the end they're holding hands, and I'm like, that might be an HR nightmare, but I'm here for you, Kate Stewart. Have your fun.
I love Kate Stewart, and I love the whole, you know, my father used to tell stories about him and all of that stuff. I do not like, I hope the birds will sing again one day.
Okay, God.
No, that was a bad line. Not as bad as the spoon line, but it was up there. But her saying goodbye was nice.
So the doctor and Mel riding on her scooter.
All the Mel stuff. Everything Mel is thumbs up for me.
Yes, including evil Mel.
Yes. Sutek
Mel. That was great. Oh, man. It's just, Bonnie Langford has had such an amazing career. And Mel Bush in the classic series didn't have that much going for her. It's glorious to see what Bonnie has been doing in the last year of Doctor Who.
And she immediately sees Colin Baker's jacket, and then later she's using Sylvester McCoy's sweater as a pillow.
And her own bow from, I can't remember which episodes, she wore that polka dotted thing in. I was just like, oh, you were so young. And she had that same look on her face. Like, I remember when I was so young that I was wearing this thing. And just all the memory TARDIS stuff. Like, her opening the drawer that has all the different Sonic screwdrivers and pulling them out and being like, well, where are we? What is happening?
So good. So, here. In the spirit of saying the idea that a villain held onto the TARDIS and was poisoning the doctor's visits without his knowledge. In that, I endorse the idea, but not the execution. I'm going to say, watch this episode twice. Cried both times at the moment where Ruby explains that she carefully ordering a cappuccino so that they can call her name so she can say, yeah, that's me, Ruby. I was found on Ruby Road. I'm your daughter. But you know what? I love that scene. I think it's beautiful. Uh-huh. I think it's emotional. I think that its emotions are earned in a way because we've had Ruby for this whole season that I'm willing to go with, of like, you know, this is a person finding their parent and being non-judgmental and grateful and wanting to make a connection. And I think that it's kind of a beautiful thing. Again, there are almost every other aspect of the resolution of who Ruby's mother is I have problems with, but that scene, I think, is, it got me twice. I knew it was coming the second time. It still got me. So I think it's a beautiful scene.
It got me more the second time, actually. I think the first time, I think I was soured on the episode at the moment of the Sutek has been here for 2,000 years reveal. And then it never got me back after that. So I didn't cry the first time through because I was just angry. But the second time, knowing what was happening. And again, you're right. Even knowing that that was coming, it absolutely hit me like a brick wall. And I was also crying at that moment. You're right. It was realized very, very well.
Same. I thought Millie Gibson's performance in that was good. I do think all of the emotions in that were earned. There are a lot of perspectives about how the adoption story has been done this year and about Ruby's motivations and things like that. And I've seen different perspectives from different people who have been adopted on all of that. But in this episode, I do want to credit RTD with the right impulse in a couple of areas. One, the end, I've got some quibbles about the execution, but I like the idea of Ruby's mother and Ruby's biological mother and Ruby's extended family getting along and that sort of that sort of reconciliation, if you will. I do like that idea very much, and I also like the impulse. It makes no sense from Sutek's interest, but I do like the impulse of having Ruby's biological mother not be a puzzle box herself, not being a magic time lord from the future or anything like that, but being just a person. Yes. I do like that impulse quite a bit.
Yes. The impulse. Yes. Agreed.
You're here.
Yes.
I wanted to mention while we're talking about adoption as well. I read into this. I don't know if this was intentional or not, but, you know, I choose to read into the fact that the doctor tells her not to go and she chooses to go. And then he watches how beautiful it is from the outside. There's a shot of Nchutagatwa there where mm-hmm. I think to myself, I think that's the doctor realizing that maybe he shouldn't be afraid of finding out where he came from. I choose to view that as a timeless child, essentially, because that has been re-canonized again this season and referenced. That's his, like, maybe I shouldn't be, maybe finding out where you're from is good, even though I was afraid of it and I told her not to do it. I was wrong about that. I choose to read it that way.
And it kind of follows from that moment to the dialogue that he has with Ruby later on in the TARDIS about what she's mm-hmm. taught him.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you're talking about the scene where he like kind of turns away from the door after watching and like leans against the brick wall and cries some more.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, I read it as the doctor being sad because that's a thing that he can't do. Because he doesn't know where he came from. And then now I'm realizing that maybe you're right. Maybe it's, I shouldn't be so scared of trying to figure it out. But I also read it as maybe I shouldn't be so scared of trying to find Susan again, because,
yes.
you know, it's not really an adoption thing, but I did totally abandon her with one shoe. So finding her again,
might husband also, and that, one shoe, but yes.
Yep. As Chip said, that also still leads directly into those lines at the end where, you know, he says, maybe I will try to find her someday. I do think that, as he says, talking about how he changes the way that he talks about family because of meeting Ruby and spending time with her and her family. I think that is all nice. It is fun to see some personal development from the doctor, even though he weirdly is much less interested in spending time with her and her family now that she has found her biological mother, whereas he was totally cool hanging with Cherry like early. I don't mm-hmm. the ending confused me a little bit in terms of doctor feels. He suddenly felt, I don't know, more 10th doctor-y at the end there, but that was
yeah,
that
some
nice.
Sort of thing she said, I thought it was like, well, yeah, I reunited you, I helped reunite you with your biological mom and all that, but I'm not going to some place to visit to find your dad. Like, I'm not, my mm-hmm. job is not to follow you. I mean, really, it is literally like, my job is not to follow you around, your job is to follow me around. Like, okay, fair enough.
Fair enough, indeed. There are a lot of moments in this episode where it feels like 15 is turning into 10. You know, we just had a big special with a bi-generation where the 15th Doctor's predecessor has done therapy and now the 15th Doctor is doing great. And at the end of this, and we get all these pronouncements and then the Doctor does a thing that makes him feel sad and guilty. And, you know, we just had one season of joy. We just had one season of joy.
I think Nchutagatwa, though, cries far more often out of either catharsis or pure joy than out of sorrow. And I think that is not what previous doctors have done. And so I like it, but you're right. There is that moment. I think, look, you're trying to build the stakes in here. So there's that moment where he's in the memory TARDIS and he sees the destruction of the universe and he lets out a scream of rage, and it's cathartic in a way, but it's also guilt ridden and all those things. And mm-hmm. I understand from a dramatic standpoint that you want to do that. And he's so good at it. And you need to have the idea that the doctor is blaming himself in this moment. And it's the turn, right? That when it's like, now, like Mel said in I think the previous episode, which is, okay, you had your thing, now let's go. Mm-hmm. Like, let's solve this. That's basically what he has to do. However, I wanted to mention about that time. So UNIT gets turned into dust. The whole Earth gets turned into dust. The whole universe is getting turned into dust, right? Many people have talked a lot about Russell T. Davis's insistence of Earth shattering or universe shattering stakes in finales, and how it's kind of a lot, right? And maybe the personal stakes are what's important anyway. And you can make arguments about this episode being, you know, in the end, the personal stakes are really what matters, even though it's told in this broad way. But I'll tell you, as a viewer, I don't appreciate being sold as if it matters parts of the story that are very clearly going to be taken back. And so when they kill everybody at UNIT, in that moment, everything is irrelevant because everything will get reset. There will be a magical who's it or what's it, and everything will get reset, which means when the Doctor gets upset and is shouting out of the TARDIS, you can maybe accept it in the moment. But as an audience member, I reject it because it's fake, because this whole story is, the stakes have been raised so high that they can never be called, or whatever you do with stakes. They can only be reset. And I was talking to Lauren because I watched this the second time with Lauren, and she said, killing people at UNIT, she's like, well, that's a bold move. That didn't get her. But when they're looking at the whole planet Earth and everybody on the planet Earth has been covered in the dust cloud, she said she just checked out of the whole episode at that point. And I think that is I think that she's right. I think when you raise that level to the point where it's obvious you will never deal with the consequences of it, that is a dramatic error. And it's the reset button is glowing. And why should any of us care about the story when the big reset button is lit up and there's a spotlight on it and Russell's hand is over it and you know he's going to press it at some point? Like, why are we even here? And that, if I have one very specific criticism of this episode, and I don't, I have many, 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 but it would be that, which is, I hate it when there is no doubt that the show is not going to back up the terrible things it's doing, because why do you even care?
I think if it was rarer, I would mind it less. Because, I mean, for me, it's not necessarily, I don't know that I would call it an error, because for me, it is basically ratcheting up the difficulty level of the rest of the story by a pretty big factor. Because I think if someone, I'm not saying RTD, if someone were to do a good enough job with everything else that came after that, it's like, yes, I, at this point in the story, I recognize that all of this is going to be reset. If you do such an amazing job of putting together the pieces and giving me emotional beats in the act of creating the solution, if it's a solution that has maybe been planted all the way through the entire season, for example, I'm looking at you, season 5 and Big Bang and Pandora opens, then maybe that's going to work and end up being okay because it felt so elegant. This was not that. But I did definitely have Pandora Opens, Big Bang sort of feels, because by the end of the Pandora Opens, like, the universe is dying. You have a cast of like 4 people. And right, it turns out that the answer has actually been coming all along the season. It's been seeded. And, you know, I thought that was a continuity error, but no, it's actually pointing to the end. Like, that's one of the rare cases where I'm like, OK, I will grudgingly accept your reset button because you did such a good job of it. This was just a giant glowing, it wasn't even a reset button, it was like a giant reset panel that you just had to accidentally nudge with your hip and suddenly everything's fine.
Yeah. I want to compare and contrast. RTD has done universe ending before in Doctor Who. Yep. But hasn't it sort of happened at the climax, and you haven't had all of this the universe is now dead or dying and we're going to spend all kinds of time with it. End of time, Journey's End, stuff like that, the big stakes and all that stuff. The stakes are still either smaller in Journey's End's case, or it happens so late in the story in the end of time that the reset button is coming soon enough that you're not dwelling on it and you're not feeling like you're wasting time. An example of doing it well, I would say, is Avengers Infinity War and Endgame.
Sure.
Where the awful thing happens at the end of the one movie, and then the second movie, rather more skillfully, is about the process of fixing it, and there is a path to the reset button, and it's all about the process. We don't get the process until the last 10 minutes of the episode in this one.
And it's like, it's weird math. Death plus death equals life.
Yeah.
What?
And, yeah. And it feels like it is all about setting up the gag that you're putting a leash on the evil dog of death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's a great, hilarious gag that you should maybe just leave in your notebook. I don't know.
I think we're running out of good things to say, Jason.
I think we...
No,
we,
I have one more.
Okay, okay.
Gabriel Wolf's voice is awesome. You know, give him anything to say, and I will be happy to listen to him talk to the doctor as Sutek. I thought that that was really well done, and like the actual animation of the Sutek figure and this, you know, big doggy caressing and cradling the TARDIS. Like, I hated that it was happening, but the way that it was happening, I thought was very well done. Mm-hmm. That's all I got.
Yeah. So, other than that, I mean,
Mrs. Lincoln.
I don't know what to say. It's possible that some of the things that are very frustrating are frustrating intentionally because there is more to come next season, but that's not a good enough excuse. That's not a good enough reason, because it just seems like a mess. 73 yards callbacks in this episode. Intriguing. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens with them.
Resented those callbacks, honestly, but I'll get to that.
The perception filter at 73 yards. Interesting. Why do you know about that? I don't know. We know. And like that was a moment that was like, oh, that's interesting, but it doesn't go anywhere or do anything. I will continue my complaint from last week, which is I don't really see how these two storylines are related, except that they are the storylines for the season, and so they got smushed together. It wasn't logical when the doctor flies to UNIT and says, oh, there's a reclusive, mysterious billionaire who's making a speech to the world, like in many other Russell T. Davis finales. Let's not talk about that, because I want to do a search for Ruby's history instead, and we'll get back to the other thing. Like, I don't understand how they felt connected, and in this, I still feel that way. I like, as Chip said, the impulse of the it's like the revelation of Rey in Star Wars being not related to anybody special, which then gets undone, but is not related to anybody special. Being kind of, I like the impulse that is like, you're not a magic box. Your mom is just a 15-year-old kid who got pregnant by a 15-year-old kid and hid it and gave the baby away because she didn't know what else to do and her family situation was difficult. Like, I like all of that, but the problem is it's the mystery that Sutek wants to solve. It's the thing that is causing snow whenever and music to play whenever they think of it. It doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't The mother being there and the time frames changing as they look, if this is all it was, doesn't make a lick of sense. Also, by the way, people don't get named by one person standing outside pointing at a sign when there's nobody else around. That doesn't make the whole mystery, the legend, legend of Ruby Sunday, while sweet in the end as being not special, just a story, you can't counter everything else, literally everything else about it in this entire season. It's so frustrating.
You know, Jason, earlier you said, like, if the Sutek thing had been just for this season, like, then I could maybe almost buy this because, okay, so the Doctor and Ruby don't know who Ruby's mom is, and that's bothering them. And for some reason, it's also bothering Sutek. You're telling me in the past 1,000+ years, there has never been another person that the Doctor and companion didn't know who they were?
Literally the Doctor has this mystery too.
Yes.
Yeah, if it was the Goblin King or something.
I don't know.
Hiding in the TARDIS for all that time. Okay.
I tried to tell myself, okay, so maybe, all right, we've just learned about the fact that the TARDIS's perception filter extends 73 yards. Oh, okay, sure, fine, new canon, that's not a huge deal. But the idea that, okay, so maybe it's because Ruby's mom is exactly 73 yards away and that's why Sutek can't see her face. there's never in 1,000 years been another person who stood exactly 73 yards away from the TARDIS. I'm just, my brain hurts. No. It literally hurts trying to figure out why. Like, I think I understand the seed of where he was trying to go. Like, we imbue stories with their importance because of our attention to them.
Totally.
And had Sutek been there for less time, and this was the first time that the Doctor and a companion had imbued another entity with that much importance, okay, maybe I could buy it. But the fact that you stuck Sutek there back in 1970,
what about if it was the Trickster or another part of the Pantheon that in the moment when the Toymaker was connecting with the Doctors, or the Toymaker's hammer split the two TARDISes, that one of the Pantheon latched onto the TARDIS, then you could say, it's been just since then, and Ruby's been the mystery since then, and they've been intrigued by it, and they want to see how it ends, that meta commentary of storytelling. But again, it comes back to the original sin here of picking up Sutek, a character that nobody who was not a fan of Doctor Who back in the past knows anything about and is totally irrelevant when we're supposed to be more accessible. Like, why would you even choose it? Other than, again, Gabriel Wolfe, he's great. You could use his voice for another character. They already did that once. You could just do that.
Yep.
I just, yeah. It's baffling to me. And I think that the hubris of, like, it always bugs me just a little bit when somebody comes and messes with, like, really big things. Like, I did not like it that RTD destroyed Gallifrey the first time. I didn't particularly... I mean, I kind of liked that Stephen Moffat just undid it because that, you know, set everything sort of back to status quo, at least in my heart. The Timeless Child thing, that was a big swing. I felt a little bit iffy about it just because, you know, digging back into previous canon and literally changing everything feels like a move made of hubris to me a little bit. But, you know, they've made it work. They've played with it. It fits in. We finally got the Morbius Doctor faces to make sense. Fine. This feels like, you did something huge like that? Well, I'm going to do that again. And it just, this time, there didn't seem to be a really good reason for it. I am very interested in the way that RTD has taken Chibnall's adoption story and sort of tried to play it out. I'm not saying he did well, but I like the fact that he is taking it and kind of running with it. But there's no taking and running this silly Sutek thing with, because, like, it's just done and gone now, and it just made me mad about 4 decades of Doctor Who. Like, that's it.
And you can't do anything with Sutek again unless you undo it and you do it again. But, you know, Sutek is a one-time villain. With all due respect to my friend Warren Fry, who loves Pyramids of Mars, it's not even that great a story, and it's a character that appeared in just one story. And, it's not a character that has the kind of resonance that Daleks or Cybermen or the Master or anything like that. You know, it's just one bad guy that he decided to turn into a god, and do the thing. It's a failure of what I thought we were getting with this new Disney series, which is a story that has relevance and interest to just the people who are watching it, to people who are new to Doctor Who. But instead, it is, it is fan wankery. That's sort of at the root of this story, and all of the other stuff that goes into it, the efforts to do an interesting story about Ruby's parentage, the effort to do something different with the Doctor's emotional makeup and all that stuff. You know, in the end of this season, it goes back to, let's do something with 60 years of Doctor Who.
It is. You say fan wankery, like, which is quite a term, but I'm going to say Russell T. Davis had a choice here of a villain. And there's nothing in this story that requires it to be Sutekh. Zero. Zero. It could be any kind of god-level villain. It's all set up by the toy maker coming back. You can have your magical characters. It could be somebody new or referenced. They reference the Mara. They reference the Trickster.
And whoever the boss is. I don't think it's Sutekh.
I don't think it is, right? Mm. And yet... And if it is, boy, did they blow that too, right? But like it doesn't need to be him. And by choosing him, you know, you're essentially choosing your own young self and your Anorak and your Doctor Who handbook over all the new viewers you've tried to get for Disney Plus. And I just think it is a and I like Pyramids of Mars. I think it's a spectacular mistake to bring Sutekh back in season one of Disney Plus and not explain him well when you introduce him, and like in a way that is totally unnecessary. I feel like his inner fan overrode his intelligent, savvy producer role, and it's just a huge misfire.
I think you're right, and I suspect, just based on watching the interviews with him on Doctor Who Unleashed, I wonder if maybe he got a little bit high on his own supply and thought, okay, we're going to start out and we're going to tell everybody that this is a great place to jump on. You don't need to know anything previously. And I am going to do all of these amazing episodes and this amazing doctor and companion who, like, they are amazing. I will give him that. But this season is going to be so great that by the time we get to the end of it, I am going to give them something that I love from classic Doctor Who, and everybody else is going to love it too, because this is going to be so absolutely fantastic that everyone will suddenly be on board and be excited to learn about classic Doctor Who because I have given them the greatest season of Doctor Who ever made. That is kind of the feeling that I get from it. And I think that you're right. It was an absolute error. And I think that it may have been an unforced error based on him thinking that he was doing a better job than he actually was.
Yeah, I think the danger of having him have supreme power is the usual, which is there's nobody to tap him on the shoulder. I mean, there are producers, but I think that they've assembled their kind of like dream team of old pals getting back together to make this with Disney's money mostly. And I don't think in that scenario there is anybody to say, Russell, this ain't it. Like,
did
I don't
you
think
notice?
Phil Collinson's going to do it. I don't think Julie Gardner's going to do it. I don't think Jane Tranter's going to do it. Nope. And so they're like, you know, somebody should have said, Russell, like, if you want to use Sutekh here, you gotta do a better job of making him accessible for the audience. And like, it's barely even attempted in last week's episode. Like, I just...
Yeah. Mm. Did you notice the timing of the producers' names who came up? Like, the RTD and Julie and Jane, I think it is. They come up, and I noticed this because I watched the episode twice, and both times it struck me that the timing of their names popping up on the left side of the screen is just as the Sutekh sort of reveal, like, his minion is about to like blow the sand. Like it is very clearly edited to be like, yes, we are the ones giving you this great gift of death.
Yeah.
And it was a gift of death.
So I think one of the big questions is, clearly there's a two season story happening here, at least in part. There are so many, either that or there are so many loose threads that it's sloppy and slapdash, and that's bad too. I would argue that even if there is a series of episodes next season that totally explain everything that goes on here, it doesn't justify this. It doesn't justify this seeming so nonsensical. Like, oh yeah, I know it seemed nonsensical at the time and for the 6 months afterward while you were scratching your head, but now that we're back, we will slowly explain some of it. I just don't think. And so I end up being frustrated by all the details and the snow falling and like, again,
yeah,
impulses I understand, but the details are just nonsensical. So, and it's not I want science, I want a deep explanation. It's like, if you're going to make every time you think about Ruby's past, Christmas carols to play and snow to fall, you can't just never explain it, right? That's bad storytelling. It can be magic, But to say, well, it's because it mattered to all of us. Well, lots of things matter to people, and snow doesn't fall. Like, and there's that line about, oh, the time was so raw because a baby was being left and there was one time machine there. It's like, no, I'm sorry, no. No,
you're selling short every other important event in anybody's life that the doctor has touched over the last 1,000+ years. That makes me mad.
Because we don't all have magic. Like, I don't know. I'm a top demander of people who, I'm a top anti-demander, I guess. People who demand explanations for everything. Every question, like, please, it's the enemy of drama. But what you can't do is never address why anything outrageous ever happens, because then you're just making things up, right? You're just not even telling a story anymore. Like, if you set us up all this way, you have to explain something about why it happened. And I don't see a lot of explaining or head nods or anything that make any sense. And like, I feel misled, right? I feel like I was sold a bill of goods by this season, because nothing in it got resolved in any or explained or links to another mystery. It's just a lot of lazy references to the boss or whatever. And I haven't even talked about Mrs. Flood, but it's again, a lazy sort of like planting of a mystery character who apparently matters, but we're never going to tell you until maybe next season who she is and what she's doing. Like, I don't know. It just is so frustrating that you would do this and then not tighten the screws at all.
I do hope that there is, like, I would be pleased if there are more nods to 73 Yards next season. And I think maybe because I just enjoyed the vibes of that episode. I enjoyed the moments that we got here that sort of related to that. As you said, I would have appreciated it if it actually had meant something more than just sort of pointing Ruby to the time frame that she needs to be in to find the DNA for her mom. Although I don't think she does there,
she doesn't.
Because then they run it at unit later. That's confusing. I mean, it did that moment of her walking up to Sutek and then dropping the screen and it breaking and her calling him the sad little god of nothing or whatever. Like, that was a good moment. It was a good moment surrounded by things that made it make no sense. But I'm still struggling to try to find the positives, because like I said, when we started doing this season way back at the beginning, I have tried to open my heart as a Doctor Who fan and be ready to just go with the flow and enjoy the nonsense, even if it doesn't make sense. And I think for the most part this season, I did a good job with that. But I found my limit, and here we are.
I hear you. And I have always been more pro nonsense. I mean, for God's sake, I love Journey's End and the End of Time. I mean, come on. But I hit a wall. The Neil Gaiman line that I mentioned in my last 2MTL: the price of getting what you wanted is getting what once you wanted. And this was the moment where there was a threshold that RTD reached. I even resented, actually, the callbacks to 73 Yards in this one, because that was my favorite episode of the year, and it felt perfectly contained with me, and the uncertainties that were left, I was perfectly happy. And what we got instead in this episode are, well, let's try to make it relevant, but not explain it. It breaks the seal of that episode.
Well put.
And tie stuff in, but now you've actually made it worse, because there was unexplained stuff, but it was in a bottle. Now there are bad explanations or incomplete explanations that don't actually add to the story that we're telling now. Really frustrating. You know, I have hated modern Doctor Who episodes before. I don't hate this one as much as some of them. I'm looking at you, the Doctor's daughter. But but this one just failed. It just failed.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the answer.
We just we love Doctor Who so much. We want it to succeed. We want it to be good. And I think that is, at least for me, where some of this frustration and anger is coming from. It's like, I love this show so much. I want it to be a success. And I think some of the things that happened here that were failures didn't have to be. That's mm-hmm. just makes it so much harder. It's like, I appreciate a big swing, but this didn't actually feel like a big swing to me. It just felt like a weird choice that fell flat.
Yeah. And there's a difference between being upset that an episode wasn't for you.
True.
And an episode that just doesn't work. And if Empire of Death and Legend of Ruby Sunday weren't for me, that's fine. I mean, you walk away, you write it off, there we go. But if the episode doesn't work, if it doesn't accomplish what it sets out to do by its own standards, then that's a bigger problem, and it's not just stylistic, it's structural, and it jeopardizes the future of the series, honestly.
Yeah.
Season 2 has already been shot.
Yeah.
There is no opportunity for course correction after this one, if any is needed.
I mean, internally, there was, right? But again, mm-hmm. I come back to the question, is there anybody inside who, because they'll never say it on the outside. I know fans are like, oh, they always say hooray. And I'm like, what do you expect? They're promoting their show. They're always going to say it's great. But did anybody on the inside look at this and say, Russell, you kind of missed it. This is a misfire. Well, you need to recalibrate. And I doubt it, because they've handed him the keys, and he's a very talented writer again, but whatever he's doing here, whatever he thinks he's doing with this sort of storytelling, I hope he's, if nobody's going to be honest with him, I hope somebody's, that maybe he'll be honest with himself and say, oh, well, this was my first go round and I had some things I wanted to do and some of it didn't work out and I'm going to learn. And I hope he's doing that, because yes, everybody in the world could agree that this was a lousy season ender, and it literally doesn't matter if that word is just reaching Cardiff, because season 2's already been shot. Yee!
Yep. You know, there are, I will recognize that, like, for every single episode of Doctor Who, there are people out there that love it. I am sure that there are plenty of people who just, like, the big moments and the weirdness and, like, just absolutely worked for. I suspect that a lot of those people are the younger viewers that RTD was sort of trying to recalibrate to reach. So, I mean, there are probably some, like, 8 and 9 year olds out there that are just eating this up with a spoon, and they are going to, you know, continue to love Doctor
Who. And
they
don't care that they don't know about Sutek.
Yeah, no, they don't care. And they don't care that it doesn't
make
sense.
It's a funny dog that gets mm-hmm. a leash put on him and dragged behind the TARDIS in the end.
Yep. There are plenty of classic series episodes that fall into that category for me, and I am still here watching Doctor Who. So I am hoping with great and deep hope that this two-parter is working for some people somewhere in a way that classic Doctor Who sometimes worked for me, and that they will stick with it. And, you know, hopefully through the next showrunners, whoever comes next that takes it over and maybe course corrects and eventually continues watching it 40 years down the road. Because that is ultimately what I want for this show, is for it to just keep going and going and going.
Yeah, I mean, people have stepped away from and returned to Doctor Who over the years, and for whatever's happening for any particular showrunner and all that stuff. It's all fine, and yes, there are people out there who very much embraced this, in part because it's kind of sort of the anti-Chibnall. the mess of Flux notwithstanding.
I mean, this was very Flux-like.
this was very Flux-like. But the mess of Flux notwithstanding, the Chibnall years were more conservative, more subdued, and this is absolutely not. And if you were bored by 3 seasons of Chris Chibnall, this absolutely may be your catnip, because this is Russell T. Davis unleashed.
A lot of things happening, really loud, things running around, a lot of feelings, a lot of loud music. There's a lot going on.
Especially lots of feelings. Especially lots of feelings and drama. And that may be enough to carry it. And that was certainly what made me appreciate RTD's years more than Stephen Moffat's years. But there's a limit. There's a limit, and there's I hit it. I swear I hit it.
Yep. Well, Christmas special.
Yeah, written by not RTD. We've got
written
Moffat
by Stephen
again.
Moffat.
So
I and feel with, like a, it, with a guest star and no other existing companion.
So it sounds to me like it's going to be fairly standalone and not tie into any of the nonsense. Like I'm looking forward to that, and I am looking forward to mid-season episodes in the next season.
Yeah.
I find that like right now RTD has here proven that his arciness is just as not for me as it ever has been. And I really did enjoy some of the episodes that we got this season. So I'm focused on that. How much I loved Rogue, how much I loved 73 Yards, how much I loved Boom. And next season, I think there are supposed to be more non-RTD writers. I'm very excited to see what they do with this show.
Right.
And I'm just going to kind of wash my hands of it. Maybe I'll go back and rewatch Rogue a couple of times and prime myself for Christmas, where we're going to get something different, I hope.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, that brings us to the end of the season. It went by so fast.
It did.
It really did. I need more episodes of my Doctor Who, even when they're not all good ones. I would like longer seasons, please.
There will be a season roundup on the incomparable Mothership, I think next week, featuring us and others.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Right. Chip, you're on that one, right?
I am.
Erica, you're on that one.
I am.
And then maybe Stephen Shapansky and Annette Weirster, too. So people should check
Stephen
that
along.
Out. Good. I always like to hear Stephen. He doesn't get to talk about Doctor Who very much, and I know he has a lot. So, all right. That wraps up the Doctor Who Flashcast for this season. We will be back at Christmas-ish. Holiday festive holiday season? I mean, I assume it's Christmas.
It is. It's called Joy to the World.
It's Christmas. So we'll visit with you then. Can't wait. Christmas. It's not even July yet to say Christmas in July. It's June. We're talking about Christmas. But we'll be back in 6 months. But until then, Chip Sutterth, it has been a pleasure talking about Doctor Who with you this season. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
And Erica Ensign, it has been a pleasure talking to you about Doctor Who this season.
I love talking about Doctor Who with my friends. Thanks.
Yay.
Guys.
We had a nice time recording a podcast. And now we say, I hope you had a nice time listening, dear listener, whoever you are, wherever you are. We will see you at Christmas. Doctor Who Flash.